Hi, this is Aaron from Gangland Wire. You're going to want to join me and Gary Jenkins for the 2018 Mob Summit in Las Vegas. That's right, folks. Las Vegas, baby. We're going to be there June 15th, 16th, and 17th. Three crime-filled days with author Frank Culotta. Gary Jenkins is going to be there as well, speaking about his app, talking about his movie, sharing his book, Leaving Vegas. And then Larry Henry of the Mafia Chronicles is going to be there as well, and many, many more. We're spending Friday evening mixing with the mob at the Plaza Hotel. Saturday from 9 to 1, we're in panel discussions about the mob. Saturday night, we're going to be rubbing elbows at the Mob Museum, and it continues Sunday from 9 to 1 p.m. at the Plaza Hotel in Las Vegas, baby. It's the 2018 Mob Summit.
Hi, this is Dave Schrantweiser from Mob Talk on YouTube, one of my projects we work on with mob expert George Anastasia here in Philadelphia. We talk about everything mob here in Philadelphia and across the East Coast in the United States. And we're here with Gary Jenkins on Gangland Wire.
Former Kansas City Police Department intelligence detective and now attorney Gary Jenkins produced four documentary films, most recently Gangland Wire, creator of smartphone app entitled Kansas City Mob Tours. Download it now. If you like what you hear, go to ganglandwire.com. Navigate to the shop page. We need you to put a hit out on our donate button. Gangland Wire True Crime Stories is produced at the Big Dumb Fun Show Studio 4. And now, here's Gary Jenkins.
Well, hello, all you wiretappers out there. We're back. We're here in the Big Dumb Fun Show Studio in the classic old Ice House building in Midtown Kansas City with my good friend and co-host, Aaron. Say hello, Aaron.
Hello, Aaron.
Well, this is the second half of the Gambino crime family soldier that we heard the first half of his story last week, and it was fascinating, wasn't it, Aaron?
Man, he has got that just that first story about stealing the car and stripping it down.
It was unbelievable.
Driving it off a tires frame, an engine, and a screwdriver, and a pair of vice grips.
That ought to be in a movie. They need to put that scene in a movie. Remember the movie Thief?
Mm-hmm.
They start off with some kind of a crime.
James Caan
and Jim Belushi. They start off with them doing a burglary. Well, they should start off a movie about an auto thief who is involved with organized crime. And the very first scene is him driving that car frame out with the vice grips as a steering wheel and turning onto the street and then getting in a car chase.
Yeah,
running the police and bailing out and going and hiding behind a post while the police all go flying by.
The interesting thing, of course, and it wasn't the first car he had to do that with. Not a police chase, but just driving off with nothing but a frame, tire engines, and maybe a steering wheel. It's funny, they'd be like, well, that's a $500 steering wheel if I've got to get another one.
The only reason he had the vice grips because he wanted this $500 steering wheel. It was a Mercedes, I think, anyhow. Was that? It's a heck of a interview, and we've got more for you tonight, folks. Andrew, it's great to have you back here, so let's just carry on with your story. Another question I have about being in this life and what this mob hierarchy provides. Now, you know, I understand they provide you protection from maybe some other thieves. I don't think you really particularly needed that, maybe from some dope dealers that might come back on you. But what about politically and in the court system? Were they able in Chicago during these years? We had guys up in Chicago that they just would ask for a bench trial to a certain and get it transferred to a certain judge. And I know one guy, a couple guys walked on murders. Harry Edelman and Tony Spilotro walked on murders. Just the judge listened to the evidence and he said not guilty. Now in Brooklyn and criminal court
in New York, it's a little bit different. In New York, it was a little bit different. I never had a friend of mine or had any sort of knowledge about a guy having a judge. I did know that I did know that a few times, you know, jurors were paid, jurors were gotten to, you know, and that would happen in any big case, you know,
yeah.
Witnesses were tampered with, you know, I myself tampered with witnesses in somebody's case, you know, just to try to, you know, deter them from, you know, pointing people out in a lineup or doing something like that. Or in this case, you know, we know of a case, the first case that Nikki was on. They got pinched in 1987, and it was Nikki, John, Lenny, there was a few other guys, Tony Lee. I forget there was a few guys on trial back then, back in 87. And Sammy Gravano is the one who found the juror. And the juror just happened to be a relative to an Albanian guy. And they were able to give the guy $60,000, and that's how they beat the first trial back in 87.
Oh, really?
So in New York, it was a little bit different. It was more about the intimidation of the witnesses as opposed to having the court people in your pocket.
Yeah, those
you know,
those
because
people,
in New York, it seemed like...
Those people in Chicago, they had that political system wired in Chicago. I never knew about New York, and there's a certain amount of corruption in any large city, but it doesn't sound like you guys...
Yeah, not in my era, though. Not in my era, Gary. And not in my area. Like in the eight, like I remember I was in the street from early 1980s, from like 81, 82, all the way up until the late 90s, until I got locked up on my second case and went away. So during that time period, that's when the FBI and the government was putting a target on organized crime.
Yeah.
So there was no room for corruption then. Back then, there was just an all-out assault on organized crime back then.
Really?
You know? Yeah, it was a big difference. You know, Rudolph Giuliani was the head prosecutor in the early 80s. You know, friends of mine were now going away when going away was never, ever even spoken about. These guys were, you know, never getting the time that, you know, they would once get for the same crime.
Right.
And that's what they did. They stepped up all of these protocols on the federal guidelines where years ago, before this, guys would do not even a third of what they're trying to give you on the first number. You know, now they're giving football numbers, 30 years, 40 years to start. Guys they're shutting guys' lights with 100-year sentences or whatever. And at the end of the day, I mean, that's what's happening today. You see guys are going to go to jail for 100 years knowing that you're expendable, knowing that, you know, these guys are feeding you a lie. There really is no honor. There's no honor. These guys will rob their own mothers with the lights off if there's money on the table. There's no honor here. That's a fabricated thing. It's a fabricated thing to brainwash young guys like me to think that when they're out there doing these things, they're justified in their actions. For many years, I carried myself thinking I was part of this honor system. I was wanted to be a man of respect. There is none. At the end of the day, when you realize who you are, Gary, you look in the mirror, and I'm a grown man, and I realize that knowing I am, I'm a criminal. Plain and simple. I'm not this honorable character that you see on TV or what they portray in the movies. I'm a guy who's told to do something, and I'm going to do it. And I'm only going to do it because it's self-preservation. So if my boss tells me to do this, it's done. You could be the nicest guy in the world, but if my boss tells me, break your arms and your legs, I'm breaking your arms and your legs because I know if I don't, I'm the guy you're going to see with his arms and legs broken.
How did you first learn you were becoming expendable, Andrew?
Went to prison on my first case. Had a 5 to 15 year sentence.
Was that on a bank robbery?
No, that was on an attempted murder charge.
Oh.
I shot somebody.
Okay.
I was away on that case. And on that case, my wife at the time was on welfare, Gary. My friends are stealing in the street. My wife's on welfare. Okay? My friends came to see me maybe once, twice a year, the first year. Maybe once, twice a year, the second year. The third year, I don't even think I got a visit. I used to get a Christmas card every year. Guys in the crew would sign it. At least you knew that they cared about the guys that were away. But now, maybe the gene pool changed or the way your life changed. Or I understand being in the street is difficult. I've been in the street my whole life. So maybe you just get distracted from being in the street and you're worried about your own problems. And, you know, you worry about your friendships and your stuff when those guys get out of prison. I understand that. But at the end of the day, when guys are swallowing sentences and you expect loyalty and you expect this, You got to give something back. But that's what organized crime is, Gary. The guys at the top just take and take and take, and they don't share. The only time you get to share in those prizes is if you get to those positions. Other than that, you're just going to keep on shoveling money to them, and you're expendable. At every venture, you're expendable.
Now, the myth is you go away and you keep your mouth shut, then your wife will, your family will get an envelope every month. It doesn't sound like that happened in your case, and I don't think it happens in many cases at all.
They did.
Well, no, it does happen. See, in my case, it's just one of many.
They did. It just was from the government.
In my neighborhood, guys are fighting for their lives. They're away doing life sentences 20 years, 30 years. You know what's happening, Gary? Nothing.
Nothing. Huh?
They're away. They might get commissary every now and then. It depends what kind of crew you got. It depends what kind of friendships you got. Of course, that also plays into it. But for the most part, your wife's going to be on welfare. And if you don't have a pocket full when you go away where your wife can hold on to that money, you're in for a long ride. You're in for a long ride. You really are. And that's definitely the myth. You keep your mouth shut, this is going to happen. And it doesn't. These days, you know what they do when you go away? Not only don't they take care of you, but these guys try to sleep with your wife when you're gone.
Well, that's cold.
That's how it's changed over the years.
Boy, that is changed.
That's the gene pool you're pulling from these days.
Man.
You know? And listen, if you're still in the street and you're still stealing and you're still doing these things in 2017, you gotta be a, I don't even know what to say. Because if you didn't learn from the years and years of all the guys before you who, well, you might think were successful, or the guys you think who weren't, you take the most successful organized crime figures you could think of and think about where they are. Think about where they are. Write them down on a piece of paper and you tell me where they are. They're either in St. John's Cemetery in Queens. They died with a gun in their hand. They died from, they got pulled out of a prison somewhere, and they died of old age, and that's where they rotted away from. There's no success stories, Gary. There's no success stories. There's no guy who did it all, and he lived to spend his money, and he lived to do this. Maybe one out of every 10,000. The other guys suffer. Their families suffer. Go to my old neighborhood where I live. That neighborhood's filled with single mothers, that the husbands are never coming home. That's the reality of it. Let these guys tell you what they want. You know, they're going to try to, you know, make out these stories to be fashionable or make them out to be honorable stories or whatever. But at the end of the day, it's a dirty, dirty life. A dirty life. Believe me, it's a dirty life.
I mean, here you are. You got sentenced for how many years?
I did 5 to 15 on the first sentence.
And then
I did almost 5 years on the second sentence. Yeah.
But so then the first sentence you did, how many years did you end up serving?
I served 4 years, went on the work release program for the last, I want to say, 10 months, 9 months, but I was still incarcerated. I had to sleep in the facility twice a week. I did that, and I didn't skip a beat, guys. I was home 24 hours. I was already robbing and stealing.
I was going to say.
Which is my life.
What?
You know, I would go back to the halfway house. As soon as I got let out, my job was a no-show job. I didn't have to be there. If my parole officer showed up at the job, they would call me. I would zoom to the location, make like I was doing something, come up, and I'd be done. But I was stealing from the minute I got out, you know, because that's the life. You know, you belong to these people. Once you're back in action, then they use you again for what you're good at doing, whatever it may be, whatever it is.
It's
all about money, guys.
I guess I'm kind of surprised when you think about this in terms of doing this it's beyond just, it's really, you know, say it's organized crime, but this criminal enterprise of day after day going out, you're stealing cars, you're bringing them back, you're doing these crimes every day. You're generating money, not just for them, but for yourself. And when you first do your first stretch, there you are, and you end up, you don't really have any money, sounds like, saved up from all of that criminal endeavor.
Well, because you spend all your money on lawyer fees, And if you have a family, your money's got to go to taking care of your family while you're away. But your money is done. It's going to be depleted,
yeah.
Especially if you go to trial. I went to trial on my case, so I went for some money. And then, you know, and you got to survive week by week incarcerated. It ain't like you're going to get a job there while you're incarcerated where you're going to be making money to take care of yourself. So money goes to them. Money goes to your family. Your family's got to eat. So when you come home, you're not going to have much. So you're going to have to start from scratch again. So it's just about, you know, starting over. I had guys from the Colombo family, guys from the Lucchese family, guys from the Genovese family. When I came home, they all came to see me. And we went out to dinner. We did this and that. Every single one of them gave me pot up money. Here's 500. Here's 1,000. Here's 5,000, 10,000, whatever it may be. You know what my boss gave me? Nothing. My boss, not a dollar.
I got two questions. One, the best score you ever had. The biggest score you ever had, I guess. The biggest score you ever had.
Besides that one in the Mercedes.
The biggest Mercedes score we ever had was a half. We robbed the bank in, I want to say it's Englishtown or Manalapan, New Jersey. We got a half $1 million.
Wow. So you had to kick some of that up to Nicky. Kick some of that up to.
Yeah, but what happened was when I committed that crime, Nicky had just got pinched. He got pinched. Within 3 months of that crime, he got pinched. I had some other issues. I was on the run at the time. When I committed that robbery, I was already on the run from law enforcement. So I committed that bank robbery when I was a fugitive from justice.
Oh, wow.
So I had a lot of problems then. I had the FBI looking for me. I had New York State Police looking for me. I had the parole department looking for me. I had a beef with two other crime families. You know, my life was definitely in the balance at the time.
That's what I was
living moment by moment, not day by day.
That's what we call spinning out of control, I think. Now, as you started to describe the robbery, describe that robbery. That sounds like it might be an interesting one.
Well, the robbery in itself went off like this, Gary. We had one of our crew members in the bank robbery crew who lived, I would say, not even 3 minutes from the location. Not even 3 minutes. Him and his wife lived in an elderly community, 50 or older or 65 or older, whatever it was. And he would frequently bank in this location. He's an old school bank robber. He would see on the specific day when he would get his checks or whatever it is that he had to do banking with, he would notice that when the Brinks truck came, the Brinks truck would come in, they would put the bags behind the tellers where there's no partition, right behind them, and if the tellers were busy, they wouldn't get to the bags until they were free to do so. Then they would take those bags in the back, load the ATMs or whatever else that they did. And he said that he noticed that he went there to cash a check. It was a holiday weekend, and he noticed that there was double the amount of bags than was previously. We went there one night. We looked at the location. We had lunch at a diner down the street the following day. We seen the truck on the path. We followed the truck to the location, seen them drop, made sure we seen all the moves. You know, you want to make sure that the truck driver's not G.I. Joe. He's not going to get out. You know, he's making $10, $12 an hour, and this guy thinks he's in Afghanistan. You don't want that. You want a guy who's a little bit more older, a little bit more lackadaisical, got 20 years on the job. You know, he's setting his ways. To him, it's not even money anymore. He's just moving product. Those are the guys you're looking for.
Yeah, really.
Anyway, these guys seem to be on the job, but the money was put where it was going to be put. We seen them do the same thing. We knew we had a score. We knew it was a done deal. The next week was going to be the Labor Day weekend. We knew that they were going to get an early delivery on the Thursday before Labor Day weekend. We knew that during that time period, they put double the amount of money in the ATM machines because they have that much more of an influx of business during those four-day span. So what we do is we go to the location early in the morning. We get my friend has his car. We doctor up the license plate with tape. We change the license plate number. We get into the vehicle. We got a crash guy across the street. We got our scanners. I put a bulletproof vest on. I go. I gear up. I got a baseball hat, sunglasses. I got clear gloves on my hands. We pull up into the back of it. I walk in. Now, it was planned that I was going to walk in, don't talk to nobody, don't do nothing. Soon as the Brinks truck drops off the money, and I say Brinks truck, but it's not Brinks, it's another company. They drop off the money. Soon as they drop off the money and that guy, that driver gets back in his truck, I walk in. Okay? It goes off without a hitch. They come, they empty the truck, they put the money on hand cart, they push the money in, they go in, they put the money exactly where my friend said it would be. I walk over. As soon as the guy gets in the truck, I walk into the bank. I walk in. I walk with my head straight. I don't look left. I don't look right. I have my eye on the target. I hit the counter. Everybody starts to, whatever. My other friend walks in 2 minutes later. He's my backup. I got no gun. I got no nothing. I'm there strictly for the money. Everybody's in shock. I jump over. I pull the first two bags. Now, you got to remember, the bags are put in like an electric blue square bag, and they're about knee high, a little more than knee high. They're filled.
Ooh,
I took the first bag. I put the first bag on the counter, the other two bags, whatever. All of a sudden, a good Samaritan comes running from the other side of the bank towards me, not knowing that this other guy is with me. So as soon as he gets even remotely close to me, the guy grabs him and throws him across the bank floor. Everybody else is in shock. We take, I believe it was four bags in total. We take the bags, two and two, we walk out. Some other woman is walking in the bank. She sees us walking towards her. She starts screaming, and she runs out of the screening. So now over the scanner, when the call goes through, I come out after her. So whoever the witnesses were outside said that a man and a woman robbed the bank because they seen her running to the car first.
That's a good one.
So I go around the back. I go around the back of the bank. I put the bags in the trunk. We put the bags in. We get in. My friend drives away. Now, my friend, he looks like a grandfather's grandfather. He's driving himself. So it took us about a minute to get to his house. We hear on the scanner that they pulled over this woman. They're going to take her to the police barracks in New Jersey. Now, they're setting up roadblocks. We're already at our destination. We're good. We get in the house. I get in the house, I go into the bedroom, I take all my clothes off, I go into the shower, I shower, put all the clothes from the robbery in a garbage bag, I shave, I put new clothes on, I come back out. My friend's wife went out, she went and bought food. We're going to stay in the house a good 5-6 hours, for sure, till everything is good. We turn on the local news. The local news has the bank robbery roped off. We see it on the afternoon news. We're listening to it. We got it all over the scanners. My friend goes out to the car. He brings the bags in. We cut the bags open. The first three bags were filled with money.
Mm.
The fourth bag was filled with receipts. So we thought the fourth bag had money in it, but it turns out it had receipts in it, whatever it was. If I'm correct in assuming as much, I remember correctly, there was three bags, money, and one bag of receipts, or two and one. It's been a long time. It was back in 96. Make a long story short, we count the money. I think we get 480, almost 500 altogether, 480, for something like that. We do the cut right there. I take my money. I put it in a gym bag. Everybody takes their money. They go do what they got to do with it. We have a plan. We're going to meet that night. We're going to go have dinner, and we'll discuss the cut with all our bosses and whatever we're going to do then. I didn't want to be in the car with money, so we took all the money from all our cuts, put it in one of the vehicles. We had one person drive that vehicle into Staten Island. I drove with my friend's wife alone. Being that I was the upfront guy, we knew they would look for me the most. So I was away from the money, whatever. We got to Staten Island. They dropped me off at my place. I got my money. I went about my business. Everybody went their own way to go to bury their money. Where were they going to go bury it? And then we'll meet that night for dinner. And that's how that ended. And then what happened was they took out a reward for us. My friend seen a reward for any information about the bank robbery, and it went off without a hitch. Everything was good with that. That was a successful bank robbery. Nobody got hurt. And that's the way you want it, Gary.
Yeah.
No, we're there for the money. We're not there to hurt nobody. We're not there for whatever. I'll tell you one thing, Gary. We had one plan in place, and this was what it was. Forever in a police pursuit, it had to be $3 million or better for us to have a shootout with the police and go all out. It's not $3 million or better, we give it up. And that was it. We'll run. We'll try to get away. Don't get me wrong.
Yeah.
We'll try to get away, but we're not going to be in the shootout. But $3 million or better, if it was $3 million or better, we're going all out. We're going to hold court right there in the street. Let the chips fall where they may. That was the game plan. Ever $3 million or better, we're going to be an after-TV, you know, a TV movie. We're going all out.
Yeah. Right. Here, Robert De Niro all of a sudden, and it's I just wonder because, you know, you're not going to stop in the middle of a pursuit to count. Is this $3 million? It only looks like $1.5 million to me.
Well, you pretty much have an idea. You pretty much have an idea. Like, we knew there was going to be a few hundred thousand in the bid. We didn't believe that it was going to be multi-millions. You know, if you get lucky, you get lucky. That's why I call it a score, because you never know the exact thing. But when you're doing all your reconnaissance work, or, you know, you're sitting on the score, pretty much you got an idea of what you're going to be walking into. We had a clock for a few hundred thousand, and we were right. You know, it turned out to be a nice score.
Was there more than four bags in the bank when you got, or was that it?
I think that was all I can carry.
Oh, okay.
So I think there might have been more.
You might have left some behind, man.
I might have left some behind, but I think I took a nice. I took a nice chunk. Everybody could eat properly, and everybody was happy.
Yeah. You could. You were in and out of the bank in under how many? Like 3 minutes.
I was in and out of the bank in probably. I would venture to say I was in and out of that bank within a minute and 10 seconds. I was gone,
man.
You gotta remember, I didn't have to do anything. I just walk in, jump the counter, grab the bags, put the bags on the counter, took the other two, jumped back over, and ran out. That was it.
Okay.
Done deal.
Now getting back, you're like out here, you're on the lam, you're doing bank robberies, and Nicky's in trouble.
He gets pinched in Florida at the time.
Right. And so
your other partner, Robert Arena, the FBI is looking for you because he had been shot and killed.
My friend Robert was murdered in the winter before the score. That score I just told you about. He was killed the winter before, and I was on the run from the parole department because they were going to question me about that and some other. I was doing so many things, Gary, that I didn't know what it was. And then all the alarm bells were going off that it was going to be about this. Now, you know this as a law enforcement guy, that if they have you under suspicion of anything, they could take your parole away from you and hold you for like a 90-day period until they do an investigation, or even hold you longer. They don't have to, you know, you're a ward of the state. They don't have to tell you anything. They could just lock you up.
No probable cause or anything.
I was doing so good. Yeah, so I was making all this money. I wasn't about to give that up. I was like, no, and I said, Gary, I said, let them earn their money. Let them catch me. That's what I said. That was my mindset. Let these guys earn their paychecks and come and get me. Plain and simple. So I ran. I had my lawyer call up the parole officer to ask what the detectives were doing there. He said nobody was here for him. We don't know what you're talking about. So my lawyer, who was Nicky Carrazzo's nephew, Jojo, at the time, so Jojo told him, he says, if you're going to tell me fairy tales, find them yourself. You have a good day. And that was it. I was on the run from that moment on, and Nicky was locked up, and We were getting bombarded with legal problems. And when they caught me in 97, early 97, I remember what the guy said when he caught me. He was like, oh, we got you, now we got everybody. So that was it. I was the last guy that they were looking for that they couldn't find, as far as my crew. And, you know, Nicky was pinched, Lenny was pinched. There was a few other guys that were pinched. And then that was it. And I was like, well, whatever, you know. Yeah, what are you going to do? They got you. It's over. It's done. And I was kind of relieved, Gary. You know why? Because I had so many problems in the street. And anybody who's been on the run knows that that kind of stress could kill an elephant. I mean, the stress from being on the run is like, it's the worst feeling in the world. I think I told another reporter one day, I told him, I said, take your most stressful moments you've ever had in your life. Times that by 10,000. And that's one day on the run.
Yeah, and that's every minute of every waking hour of every day, you've got that twist in your gut.
You're waiting for the shoe to drop. Yeah. You're waiting for the shoe to drop. Plain and simple.
That would be tough.
You know, and it's horrible. It's a horrible existence, you know. Listen, I was fortunate enough in my life, Gary, where I made lemonade out of lemons. I had some fun. I had some times that I could sit here and laugh about. But you need that kind of levity in your life to survive those hardships.
Really?
You know, you need that levity. And those levity, that those funny times got me through. And even on the run, people say, how was it? Well, sometimes it was funny as hell. You know, sometimes, you know, you would just find yourself in the oddest situations, you know, and it is what it is. But the times when you laugh are the times that get you by, like even when you're incarcerated. I had fun with my friends because I was with similar guys with my situation, guys from different crime families when I was away. And we would laugh sometimes for hours. And you're sitting there, not that I'm taking my situation lightly or not having any remorse for my crimes, because if you don't, you're going to go insane.
Yeah,
you're
going to
go insane.
That. So I've always been to a few guys like you, and I always wonder, you got brains, you got personality, you got a real outgoing personality. You speak well. You got a good brain. You can put together things. And if you had taken all that energy, now it wouldn't have been as much fun.
You forgot mechanical aptitude.
Mechanical aptitude. if you'd have put all that together and created some kind of a business, you know, you would have had a whole different life.
I did create business.
Successful.
Gary, I had a good business. Yeah, so I totally understand what you're talking about, but you got to also understand this. We're all creatures of our environment.
Yeah.
You know, we are who is around us. And, you know, I've had this around me since I'm a baby. And, you know, truth be told, it was normal for me. This activity was normal because all I knew growing up was guys who I became, guys who, you know, were on the fringes, the guys who were knock-around guys, the guys who were in the street, the guys who gambled, the guys who borrowed money from Shylocks, the guys who were looking for the score, the guys who were looking for a better way of life, you know, because their situations were dire or they didn't come from a family of means or all of these things added up. So I was involved with that from a very young age. Yeah, if somebody was there to school me, my father was never around. I'm not blaming my father for my decisions, not by one iota. I'm a man. I did these things on my own. But I never had nobody to tell me I was doing wrong, Gary. I had never had nobody to tell me this isn't the way to do this. And it just, once I started to do these things and I started to get older, now there's no stopping me because now it's all I know.
In fact, that was what
and
you had was people that were
point is.
People that were nurturing you and mentoring you for this life.
Exactly, and they're nourishing you and they're trying to teach you to do things the way they want you to do it. So now you're becoming almost robotic. You're almost becoming, you know, your thoughts aren't your own. I tell everybody this. I didn't start thinking for myself as Andrew DiDonato until the day I started cooperating with the government. And everybody thinks that decision came lightly. There were days I hated myself, never thinking that I did the right thing. But now, as the years go on and on, because so much time has passed, I realized that there would have been so much more in my life. And although I had those certain friendships, most of it, there weren't friends. There's no friends in that life. See, Gary, in my neighborhood, you can kill your best friend. And it's accepted behavior. Don't you dare tell on him. Tell me that's not the sickest thing that you could think about. It's okay to kill him, but you can't tell on him.
That's you know.
I mean, the mentality is warped.
That's you know, mentality is still out
it
there.
It is what it is. You know, people who call me, yeah, well, you know, a lot of people who call me this, call me that. But at the end of the day, they were going to put me in a box.
Right. So let's talk about
that
a little bit.
I took the best tools that I had. I took the best tools that I had at my disposal. And that, you know what that was, Gary? I beat them with the truth. That was the only thing I had on my side because I couldn't win that war. I was involved in a ton of violence in my life. I was no stranger to it. You want to go in the street and you want to go and you want to throw shots? Let's do it. I was the first one out the car, but I couldn't win that battle. I was in a situation where the boss of the family was looking to put me good night. There's no winning that because there's too many guys around you who you love and you trust who are going to be there to set you up only because they're trying to get a leg up in that life and prove to him that they could do these things. Guys that you went on dates with, slept over their houses, dated people close to them, hung out with them. You know, 2-3 o'clock in the morning, they were ringing your doorbell when they were impressed, and you were there, gun in hand. These are the same guys that are going to put your lights out. That's organized crime right there in a nutshell.
Really? And it wasn't...
So your friendships... What?
I just wanted to say, because much... I mean, it's the way that the organization works is if your boss tells you to do something, you do it.
You do it. And what happens when he tells you, guys, think of somebody you grew up with. Think of a best friend you have or somebody who means the world to you. And then they tell you to go and you go clip that guy. Because he did A, B, C, and D. And you know it's wrong. You know you're going to hurt this guy for no other reason except that this guy has got a conflict of interest, or this guy and him, they butt heads. This guy didn't do nothing wrong. This guy might have been too good at his job, and this guy's jealous of her. This guy just wants to take over his spots or his money. And you know it's wrong. But you can't say a word, because then you're next.
Nicky didn't want to kill you. Because he thought you were going to testify against him or anything.
No. He wanted to kill me because he thought, I give you for instance.
Yeah.
Information is power. Information is dangerous. Nicky thought I was making this money with his robberies, and I was had these drug guys underneath me, and he didn't think he was getting a full piece of the action, is number one. Number two, he knows I had information about the Robert Arena homicide that could put him right in the spotlight. When you have information about a boss, no matter how good you are to him, he can't sleep at night knowing you know this. You understand? You could be the nicest guy in the world. You could be the nicest guy. He knows that someday that it might not be, and he can't take that chance. And it's an old saying, it's always safer to send flowers. So you send flowers, and now you don't have to worry about that coming to bite you in the ass.
Well, I understand.
So that's
that.
The whole idea of it.
Yeah, I worked.
And that's why he wanted me dead.
That's not just in the mob. I worked for a guy like that on the police department. He couldn't stand it if he thought somebody who worked for him might know something, even in the least little bit derogatory about him. So he would make a move to discredit you and get you moved on where you couldn't be, nobody would believe you.
That's the difference.
Yeah.
That's the difference, Gary, between the police department and organized crime circles. In organized crime circles, they're not going to move on. They're just going to shoot you in the head.
Right. They're going to go ahead and put you clear out of it. They won't just discredit you so nobody'd ever believe you again.
Well, that's not to say that cops don't ever shoot another cop in the back as an accident.
And basically, at the end of the day, everybody in my crew knew it. Even the FBI knew it when they pinched me. They knew I was on an oxygen tank. They knew that these guys were going to kill me any day. They knew it. So if they know it, what are they? They woke up one day and they just got this information. The FBI just woke up knowing that I was on the hit parade? No, because it's out there. People talk when they're not supposed to. It's just common knowledge. People talk about things every day. The word was out there, and I wasn't in good graces with him. So be it. Would I have ever thought to do anything to hurt him? No, I would never. If this wouldn't have played out the way it did, I would have still been that idiot, Gary, who took 100 years on the chin and threw his life away. But when I'm facing 50, 45, 50 years, and I know that I'm going to come home to a bullet at the end of it, or they're going to try to kill me while I'm incarcerated, all bets are off now. I'm protecting the same people that want to put me to sleep. For what? I'm not justifying my actions because I grew up knowing the game. And in the game, I know that you don't do this. At least if I'm going to die, it's going to be on my terms, nobody else's. You got to eat your own arm. If you're going to become this other person and you're going to think about cooperating, they expect you to eat your own arm and self-destruct before that happens. They want you to fall on the sword, so to speak.
So how did the FBI, they make their approach? Did they come visit you in the jail, in the county jail?
No. How they made their approach was when I got locked up, they found me. When they found me because I came in to see Nicky's partner, Lenny, who I have the utmost respect for. I really do. Even to this day, Lenny was one of my favorite people. He was just a gregarious guy, always smiling, always. He was just a nice guy to be around. He had a nice persona about him. You know, he had called me in for something, and I went in to go and see him. He was out on bail on a case, and I was on the run. Nicky was pinched already. I spoke to him, and the way that I got it from the agents is that they were watching him. When they watched him, they got a line on me when I went to go and see him. And when they went to go and see, when I left, then they got where I was staying. When they got where I was staying, they sat on the location for a number of days. They went to another location where they knew I would frequent, and they had surveillance on both locations. Then they came, they pinched me one morning, and then when they pinched me, they started talking about wanting to talk to me on that day. I stonewalled them, of course, because I did my regular thing. But then what happened was when I went to my arraignment, I knew I couldn't get bail because I had a parole hold. So when I had the parole hold, I knew I wasn't getting out. I knew they were going to hold me. There was a lawyer there for me. Now, the lawyer that they brought for me was a guy, and they didn't. And when they brought the lawyer, Gary, the lawyer wasn't because they were looking out for me. The lawyer was there because they was looking out for them. You understand the difference?
Yeah, I get it.
They put a lawyer there to see what the charges were because they knew that I was under suspicion of the double homicide, and they wanted to see if I got charged with it, and they wanted to see what the charges were going to be and if it was, you know, RICO-related or anything that I had to do with them. So the lawyer was there for that purpose and that purpose only, and I just didn't like the whole feel of it. So I told the lawyer, I said, listen, you're here. Means absolutely nothing. I said, they're going to remand me no matter what. You can't do nothing for me. If I'm going to use a lawyer, it's going to be JoJo anyway. I'm going to use JoJo. I'll call him when I get back inside. When I was in the Brooklyn House of Detention at the time. The feds came 2 days later and they rearrested me for federal charges. And when they rearrested me, they took me in. And then that's when they discussed with me about my life being in danger. You know it and I know it. They said, you know you're getting clipped. If we know you're getting clipped and you don't know it yet, you're the only guy who don't know it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, all the light bulbs were going off in my head. It was just, you know, here I am. You know, what am I going to do? I got to be somebody I was born to hate, Gary. You know, I was born to hate the person that I had to be. You know, it goes against every instinct that you have. What are your options? What are my options? These guys are going to kill me. Whatever chance they get, whenever they get that chance. It's coming, and it's coming fast because they still know that this information, if this information has ever transpired to the authorities, he knows he's getting pinched at some juncture. I waited a while, and then I did what, you know, I'm not proud of it. I'm definitely not proud of it. I'm not proud of any of the criminal activity I was involved in, but I made a phone call, and I made the arrangement, and it happened. And the rest is history. And here I am today. But you know what? I got to do something I never did. I got to spend time with my family. I never spent time with my family. To me, giving your family money was being a man.
Well, you aren't going to be able to do that if you're going back to jail.
I put my mother through hell, and, you know, I missed the best years of my son growing up. And these are things that, you know, the collateral damage around you. You know, and now it was time to be that person to start to do what was right for me and maybe live out to my potential and stuff like that. It had nothing to do with jail time. I've been in jail my whole life. This had nothing to do with not wanting to go to jail. More of my friends were in jail than out of jail. The whole idea was to go to jail for them, knowing that my wife was on welfare the first time. Now they're looking to kill me the second time. How many times have I got to kick myself in the ass? And basically, that's it.
That's taking.
Now here I am talking to you.
That's taking loyalty a little bit too far, I think. But you know,
and I was that guy. I ate and bred that guy. That was me. You know, and you know, I see all these people with these talk shows and all this thing or whatever. And you know, it's very easy to judge a person until you go through these things, until you're affected in the same way, and you deal with the ugly side of that life.
Yeah.
You know, just because you're good at what you do, Gary, and you report all your money and you do all these things, that doesn't grant you safe passage. In this life, guys get killed for being too good at what they do, out of jealousy, out of envy. You're dealing with the most ruthless people in the world. Everybody starts to lose track of that because they watch too much TV and they watch too much glorification. But you're with the scum of the earth. And I was no different. Believe me, I'm no better. I was right there with them, being scum.
Well, you're on a different...
Plain and simple.
You're on a different path now. Sounds to me
I'm definitely on a different path, brother. I do all the things. I'm happy.
I don't think you're doing the things that you used to do. If you did, you wouldn't be out
no,
there.
No, those days are over, Gary. They're just stories that we tell.
Yeah.
And, exactly.
Now, do you...
I go to work every day.
Do you lay low now? I mean, I'm sure you're still using...
Yeah, well, you know what I do?
I pay attention. I'm sure to what's around you. Well, I even do that.
Well, what I do is I just take all the precautions that I did when I was in the street because they wanted me dead then. They wanted me dead now. There's no different levels of dead. So I take the same precautions I always did. I carry myself in the same fashion. I always know that someday my past can't catch up with me. And when it does, Gary, I'm going to do what I always did. And I'm going to die like a man that day, whenever it may be. And we're going to do what we need to do. I don't want it to happen. I don't wish it to happen. But that's the only day that I would ever break the law again. And that is to protect my loved ones and to protect myself. And then let the chips fall where they may. And I'm not trying to be tough here. I'm just saying it the way it is.
So
it came to my loved ones or came to my own personal safety. Jail doesn't matter anymore. I go all out.
What I was going to say was, so it wouldn't be maybe the last time you've answered the door with the screen door closed and a gun in your hand.
Well, those days are old. I'm not walking around with a gun in my hand.
He didn't have a gun in his hand. At least he's not going to admit it here.
No,
for
he can't.
Sure.
Yeah. I mean, you're that.
Well, Gary, you are a police officer. I'm not
he is an attorney. Now, I don't want you to indict yourself.
Well,
here.
I'm a lawyer now, so this is all you got. Lawyer client privilege. I can't rat you out on anything.
Yeah. That's all I need to. Well, anyway, listen. Gary, you're a gentleman. Whenever you want to speak, I'll speak to you anytime.
Right.
And it was good to talk to you.
Yeah,
and I'm glad you're doing well.
I'm glad you're doing well. And
all right. And if this,
yeah. Now you got grandkids.
Yeah, I'm doing well, sir.
Grandkids?
Thank you very much for asking.
Do you have grandkids?
As a matter of fact, I wish. Not that I know of yet.
Well,
you know what? Me and my son had a. You know, it's been a long time. I haven't seen my son in a long time because of my situation.
Yeah.
But I would love to know if I did. If I did, it would be nice.
Well,
you know, I pretty much got a solid relationship with 99% of my family.
Yeah.
And my son is the last, you know, he's the last piece of the puzzle. You know, and it's difficult because of where he is and where he's located.
Yeah, I understand.
And I just want him to live his life. And as long as I know he's good, I'm good.
All right. Well, good. And hopefully... I'm not really a praying kind of guy, but I would say a little prayer here that one of these days you'll heal that relationship and you'll have a relationship with your grandkids.
Well, the relationship is not the issue. The issue is
it's where he lives.
You know, I stay away because I don't want to put nobody in harm's way.
I see. Well,
put it that way. I keep away. I keep out of their lives because I chose that life.
Yeah.
My mother didn't. My sisters didn't. My son didn't. I chose that life. So I owe it to them. I let them live their lives. And I don't ever want anything that I've ever did to spill over.
I understand.
They've already went through enough in their lives.
I understand.
Because of me. You know?
Well, Andrew, this has been great.
All right, sir.
We'll let you get on about your business. And I appreciate it. If there's ever anything I can do for you, don't hesitate to get hold of me. And I will, sir.
Hey, listen, send me a copy of this. I would love to hear it.
I will. What I'll do is I'll put it up, and then I'll send you a link, and you can download it. Then you can have your own copy of it. How about that?
All my best to you and your family, guys.
Right.
Happy holiday. Be safe.
Okay, you
enjoy
too.
Enjoy your good holiday. New year with all the health in the world.
Okay, you too.
Thank you so much, Andrew.
Thank you, Andrew. Good night. Well, that was quite a story, Aaron. That's a lot more than I bargained for.
There was a couple stories in there.
All right.
Yeah, major public service announcement.
If you have a friend who has a problem with drugs or alcohol or a relative or a coworker, Make your first call the first call. Call 816-361-5900 or go to their website, www.firstcallkc.org. What do you got to say to that, Aaron?
I've got to say, folks, you need to get the documentary that started it all, Gangland Wire, available for purchase or rent on Amazon. And then you're going to want to go out and get the Kansas City Mob Tour. Download the app for $1.99 on your iPhone. You can take your own personalized tour of notorious mob locations in and around Kansas City. And if that's not enough, ladies and gentlemen, you need to get the book that Gary just wrote this year, Leaving Vegas.
How FBI wiretaps ended mob domination of Las Vegas casinos.
It's a great read, and it's an even better listen. If you get the Kindle version, you can hear the words from the mouth of the men that did it. The wiretaps from the Argent case, Gary distilled them down. They're the words from Tuffy DeLuna, from
Lefty Rosenthal,
from the genius,
Alan R. Glick.
That's right. And transcribed so you can read what they're saying, because sometimes it's hard to understand. They've got an accent, and they use words that are colloquial to being Italian, I guess.
Some of them, yeah, like
Gumar.
Gumar, Minga, Mugari.
Parapeep.
What else? Parapeep. Words like that. Parapeep, bada bing.
Yeah.
Anyhow, moving right along. Let's close this out, Aaron. Why don't you say goodnight, Aaron?
Goodnight, Aaron. Music provided by Odd-O-Matic. Follow them on Twitter at Odd-O-Matic Music.